I believe everyone is aware that our next test is day after tomorrow. Thursday morning of this week is our next test, and the papers are due a week from tomorrow. They're due on Wednesday, week from tomorrow, by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But any paper that is turned in later than 4 o'clock in the afternoon next Wednesday will only have 2 points deducted from the semester course, provided it is turned in within 5 school days after that. Within 5 school days after it's due. After that, there will be 5 points for each week that it's late, as in the case of the previous paper. Now, we were looking last time at the Hebrew materials for study of the Old Testament text. And under this, we were looking at capital A, Survey of Recent Advances. We noticed, number one, the researches of Abraham Perkovich, who discovered so many new manuscripts. And of these manuscripts, of the genuineness of them, I don't think anyone has any questions. It would have been impossible to have forged any great number of these manuscripts, and certainly to have made them appear like old manuscripts as they claim to be. He has this tremendous number of them, the great bulk of them being manuscripts of the Bible, but some manuscripts of other types, Hebrew manuscripts, which he gathered and which are in the Lenenberg Library. And in your Kittel Bible that most of you use for a Hebrew Bible, one of these manuscripts that he found is the manuscript that is made the basis of the text there. Then we notice, second, the Cairo Geniza. There were many of these Genizas. Wherever there was a synagogue, there was something of a Geniza, but usually they were taken out and buried. Some think that a number of Abraham Perkovich's manuscripts came from the Cairo Geniza. There's no proof. He was very secretive about where he got them. But from the Cairo Geniza, hundreds of thousands of bits of manuscripts, some of them only a few inches in size, some of them including hundreds of pages, have been taken to the museums and libraries of the world, the largest collection being at Cambridge University in England. And these are throwing light on many aspects of the life of the Middle Ages in the Levant, but for our purpose, what is of most interest, of course, is the biblical manuscripts and the manuscripts that throw light on biblical activity about 1,000 years ago. And they have proven very important in this direction. We spoke, third, about the discovery of the Dead Sea Scroll. This discovery, which was made in 1947 in the first place by the Bedouin, was followed up by later investigations by trained researchers and also by further searching by the Bedouin. And so altogether, maybe 100 different caves were explored in the area where the first cave was. And out of those 100, I believe 11 is the total thus far among those that have yielded manuscripts. But none of them have yielded manuscripts comparable to the manuscripts found in the first cave, that is, in size or in preservation. In the first cave, you had manuscripts wrapped in linen cloth and put in pots, wrapped up in closed in pots, so they were very well preserved. And we have 7 different manuscripts from there. One, the complete manuscript of Isaiah, practically complete, is the only complete manuscript of a whole biblical book of any size that was found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. There was another manuscript of Isaiah also, not nearly so well preserved. In fact, at first it was counted as 2 manuscripts, because they were 2 parts which were separate, but which were easily seen to be part of the same manuscript. I received a letter not long after the discovery of these, said, "Is it true that it has been proven that there were 2 Isaiahs, because a manuscript of the second Isaiah was found among the Dead Sea Scrolls?" And it is true that the accounts of the discovery say that there was the great Isaiah manuscript almost complete, and then there is a second Isaiah manuscript. However, I was glad to be able to write the Inquirer and say that the so-called second Isaiah manuscript, though it has many broken parts in it, includes portions of every section of the book of Isaiah. and therefore has nothing whatever to do with the idea of whether Isaiah wrote the whole thing or whether he wrote a part and part were by other authors. This is a manuscript of the book as a whole, but with sections missing from every part of the book. This this second Isaiah manuscript was one of the group of manuscripts that the Hebrew University originally secured. The other one was secured by the Syrian archbishop, and the Jews had to pay $500,000 to get those eventually. They brought them to this country, showed them around different places here, and then, desiring to sell them, they advertised in the Wall Street Journal that these manuscripts were for sale. But in the end, after all their efforts, the one who bought them was the Hebrew University, which had had the chance in the first place, but had not been in a position to take advantage of it then, and now had to pay maybe 30 times as much, at least, as they would have if they'd gotten them in the first place. Now, these other manuscripts from the Dead Sea, include a few that have a fairly large section of one of the books of Samuel or of the Psalms, and include certain commentaries, a commentary on the first two-thirds of Habakkuk, which will quote a verse and then have a comment on it, and of course that gives you the text of Habakkuk, and a few sections thus of some size, but most of them are manuscripts that were exposed to weathering and the rats got in among them. They were largely, they consist of little tiny bits, sometimes only five or six words. But you find five or six words on one side taken from maybe two or three lines, and on the other side of the page you find five or six words. And then you hunt through your concordance and try to find a place where those words would occur at about that distance apart, and see how they fit, and try to look for some other scraps that seem to be in the same handwriting. And a number of scholars have devoted a great deal of attention to studying these manuscripts. After the these had been found, these scrolls from this place, which is called Qumran, Q-U-M-R-A-N, after an old, ruin which was near these caves. And this ruin had been known for years, but never much great attention paid to it. It was excavated, this ruin, and it was found to be the headquarters of the people who made most of these manuscripts. It was evidently a group of Jews who were dissatisfied with the attitude of the people in Jerusalem and who separated themselves from the leadership of the Jerusalem Jews and who devoted themselves here to communal life and to studying the Bible and their various commentaries. We have among the documents, we have rules for their life together and so on. But in this headquarters, we have a scriptorium, a room in which is laid out very evidently as a place for copying manuscripts. And so it's very evident that this group of people copied these manuscripts there. And probably it was because of the coming of the Roman armies, which destroyed Jerusalem in A.D. 70, that they hid these manuscripts in the cave, thinking that they would get them back again later on. There have been two... you had a question?
I'm wondering if these groups of Jews, are they asking Jews, or are we making speculation as to what they were?
It's a matter of terminology. There are among the writing, in the writings of Pliny and of Josephus, there is reference to groups of Jews that lived like these dead out in the wilderness, whom they call Essenes. The writings that we have found by these people nowhere use the word Essenes. And there are certain differences in their customs from those which are described by Pliny and Josephus. Whether these differences are enough for us to say they're not Essenes, or whether they are comparatively minor and we say they're simply a different group of Essenes, we have no way to prove, because we don't have the word Essene used in any of their writings. But the word Essene, E-S-S-E-N-E, has been known to us for a long time because of the writings of Josephus and Pliny, and describes groups who lived in the wilderness, like these, but not exactly. That is, their description isn't exactly like the rules found here. So you can't prove they were Essenes, you can't prove they weren't Essenes. They were a similar group, undoubtedly. But whether they are the same, connected to one large group of which they speak, or a different related group, we just don't know. But the soon, among stores in Jerusalem, people began to find manuscripts for sale, or bits of manuscript, which were similar to these scrolls from Qumran, but a little different. And enough different that they wondered where they came from. And someone managed to persuade the Bedouin who had found these and were now offering them for sale there to tell where they came from, and it was about 10 miles south of Qumran. So these are Dead Sea Scrolls, but they're not Qumran Scrolls. This other group of scrolls. They are found in a valley called the Wadi Murabba'at. Now Wadi, W-A-D-I, is the modern word for a gorge or a stream bed. W-A-D-I, and then Murabba'at is M-U-R-A-B-A-A-T. M-U-R-A-B-A-A-T. Writers about the Dead Sea Scrolls are apt to mean the Qumran Scroll rather than the Murabba'at Scroll. But the Murabba'at Scrolls are very interesting, and it is unfortunate that they receive so much less than the attention they deserve. I'd like to explain why I think it was. But the Murabba'at Scrolls are found in caves in a very steep gorge, high up on the side of the gorge, in a very desolate section of the desert there. There they are found these scrolls, many of them much more complete than most of the Qumran scrolls. And they are different from the Qumran scrolls in that most of them can be definitely dated. And they come from about 60 years later than the latest of the Qumran scrolls. They were written by the Jews, or gathered by the Jews, who were revolting against the Romans in 133 A.D. And some of them are actually letters from the leader of that revolt of the Jews in 133 A.D., a revolt which was put down and completely destroyed by the Romans. But these scrolls contain a considerable number of biblical scrolls, material in Hebrew, in Greek, and in Latin, and also other types of material there, most of which can be rather definitely dated, so it gives us a definite standing point for comparing the writing of the Dead Sea Scrolls. They are historically thus more solid than the Qumran material. They're more solid. Many of them are more complete than most of the Dead Sea material. But most of the critical scholars are not greatly interested in the Murabba'at Scrolls, because the biblical scrolls there are just about identical with the text we have in our Bible today. And therefore they don't prove anything new. Well, they don't prove anything new, but they do prove something of great interest. They prove particularly to an evangelical Christian. They show that the text of our Old Testament today, of which our manuscripts only go back to about 900 A.D., is almost identical with the text that the Jews had in 133 A.D. Now that's a tremendous thing. It is very difficult to think of documents being copied and recopied and recopied, and as the old ones wear out, new copies made, through a period of 1,000 years and hardly any changes of importance coming in. It shows the tremendous care that the Jews made in copying the Hebrew manuscript, and it's evident that we can trust the text of our Hebrew Bible, that it is very, very close to that which they had in their hands in 133 A.D. Now, these scrolls are nearer to our present text than some of the material found at Qumran. So the material of Qumran containing some that is more different, naturally it gets more attention from scholars, particularly from unbelieving scholars. But the great importance of the Murabba'at Scrolls deserves to be stressed. Now, yes, Mr. Reed?
How extensive was it? Well,
there are, I don't have exact figures here, but there are quite a few scrolls, quite a few biblical scrolls in Hebrew and in some in Greek and some material in Latin. But, of course, not nearly. Well, if you would eliminate from the Qumran material everything that is, say, less than 5 inches square, something like that, I wouldn't be surprised if you had just about as much from Rabbah as you have from Qumran. But, of course, we have tens of thousands of little tiny scraps from Qumran, and they're trying to fit those together and see what they can get from it. Yes, sir?
How does the text of Qumran grow here like this?
Yeah, that is too important a thing, too extensive to answer in one sentence. We'll take a little longer than that. I'll come to that in just a moment. That is, of course, very important. Mr. Varner?
You said this is over about 60 years later than Qumran. Is that when you're dating Qumran?
No.
70 years?
No, about 60 years later than the end of the Qumran.
The end of the Qumran?
Yeah. You see, the Qumran material, it is generally thought by scholars now, includes some material written as early as 150 B.C. And they were probably hidden about 66 A.D. And so you cannot say for sure when within the period from 150 B.C. and 66 A.D. a particular thing was written, or you can make a guess according to the type of letters used and so on. And they feel quite sure, for instance, the Isaiah scroll, the main Isaiah scroll, is quite early. But none of it can be later than 66 A.D. It's definitely all before that. Now, the Murabbah material, some of it may have been written before 133 A.D., but probably not a great deal before. And those that can be definitely dated are dated in the course of that insurrection. Now, the material from Qumran is of great importance for two reasons. Now, this is speaking from the viewpoint of general Christianity rather than specifically the Old Testament. It is of very great importance for two reasons. In the first reason, because of the biblical texts, which are tremendous evidence of the accuracy with which our text has been preserved. Now, most of the books on the subject will incidentally somewhere make the remark that the overwhelming mass of the material at Qumran is almost identical with our present text. They will rather incidentally make that remark somewhere. And then they'll devote a great deal of their attention to the little bit of it, the comparatively small amount of it, that differs somewhat. And if you read it hastily, you get the impression that there's considerable difference. But actually, the bulk of the material, most of the books will say somewhere, that the bulk of the material is very, very close to our present Hebrew Bible. But of course, they are particularly interested in the exception. Now, the Isaiah scroll has quite a good many differences from our present Isaiah scroll. But these differences are mostly very minor matters, and matters of a type which can easily represent the error of a scribe who copied hastily and carelessly. He wrote a beautiful hand. It's a beautiful manuscript, but it was carelessly copied. And it has a great many little spelling errors that are perfectly obvious. That they don't represent any early text. They just simply represent a mistake in copying, and all agree on that. When it was first discovered, for a time, there was a great deal of attention paid to its differences from present text, and as if we had something, learned something of how different the early text was. But by this time, most scholars agree that this Isaiah scroll, like the other one, represents actually a text very, very close to our present text. I am told that in the original RSV, there were 21 changes made in the translation on the basis of this Isaiah scroll. And I am told that members of the committee felt that a mistake had been made, that these changes had been based on purely scribal errors, and that members of the RSV committee desired that it be that these changes be done away with and only one change be included. Now, I've heard that quite indirectly, I have no direct contact with the RSV committee, but I think it gives a fair picture of the attitude toward the Isaiah scroll. Little errors of no importance, simply a scribal error. Mostly a text very, very close to our present text, but occasionally something that looks like a change, and in view of the many typographical errors in copying, how can you be sure whether that's just a scribe's error or whether it actually represents a different text known to the copyist of that manuscript? So the Isaiah manuscript, which received a great deal of attention for a little while, is now not given near the prominence that it was. In the course of the examination of these various scraps, those men who are devoting a great deal of time to their study have issued statements that they find among them evidence of three recensions. That is, they find some of them which are very close to the Masoretic text, as we have it. They find others which are like the text of the Septuagint, where it differs from the Masoretic text. And they find some which are like the Samaritan Pentateuch, where it differs from the Masoretic text. And therefore, some of them will say, there were three different recensions of the Hebrew Bible in circulation at that time, of which only one has been preserved in our Hebrew Bible. Now, I believe that is an erroneous deduction from the facts. But that is a statement you will find in a good many books today. If that statement be accepted at face value as proven, it still would mean that our present text goes back almost identically, with very slight changes, to the time of the 1st or 2nd century B.C., which is a tremendous thing when you think of the possibility of errors in copying and recopying. But it would also mean that there were two other texts at the time, that is, as time had passed in the centuries previous, changes had come in naturally in the course of time, and that there were these two other texts also accepted, which are represented today in the Septuagint and in the Samaritan Pentateuch, but which were dropped as far as the Jews were concerned. Now, I do not think that is a correct conclusion from the fact, for this reason, that the great bulk of the material agrees with our Masoretic text. The evidence for these assumed two other recensions is comparatively slight. There is such evidence, undoubtedly. And I feel that the situation was that the scripture was kept in Jerusalem, copies of the scripture, copied with great care, but that Jews all over Palestine were anxious to have copies. And consequently, people would come to Jerusalem and make copies. Or a man of means might send and hire someone in Jerusalem to make a copy. Then these copies would be taken. I'm speaking of the century before the time of Christ. These copies would be taken to various towns and kept there. And when somebody in the neighborhood wanted a copy, he would ask the owner to let him make a copy. And he might give him permission, and if he did, was the man who copied a good copyist or a poor copyist? Did he have money enough to hire a good copyist or a poor copyist? Naturally, changes would come in these popular copies, kept by individuals in different parts of Palestine. And they might compare their copies with the copies of others in their town, and thus there'd come to be a little different text, perhaps in different places. But everybody would recognize that in Jerusalem was kept the copy that was made with great care. And that was the standard copy, was the text which they had in Jerusalem. Then when these Qumran people settled out here in this colony and broke their relations with the leaders of the Jews in Jerusalem, the bulk of them took with them copies of the text as it was in Jerusalem. The text which would be very, very close to what had been so carefully copied there and preserved as the main text. But some of these people would have come from different parts of the land and would bring them with them copies of certain books in which there might be errors that had come in those regions. And thus, very naturally, among all the dozens of manuscripts that they had, there would be a few which would represent these erroneous text that had developed in popular use in various parts of the land. And the result is we have a little evidence of some which are similar to the Septuagint in places where it differs from the Masoretic text, or similar to the Samaritan Pentateuch in places where it differs from the Masoretic text. But there are comparatively few such places anyway. On the whole, the text agree remarkably closely. But as the bulk of the text fits with the text that has been passed on down. However, the important thing there is that the great value, to my mind, of the Dead Sea Scrolls is that they show how marvelously, carefully, and accurately the text of the Old Testament has been preserved through these centuries by men copying and recopying. And I defy anybody to copy a book the length of Psalms or Genesis without making at least one mistake in copying. Chances are, if you copy two pages, you'll make two or three mistakes in copying. We can think one thing and write another, at least I can. I imagine most of you can. It's very, very difficult to keep mistakes out. And the Septuagint has not been preserved with anything like the care with which the Hebrew Old Testament has been preserved. But now the Dead Sea Scrolls receive their greatest attention throughout the world from a different reason altogether from this. After their discovery, they were known to Old Testament scholars who were greatly interested in it. But the world at large became interested in it because of the writings of a man in New York, which is based on the writings of a man in Paris. And this man in Paris evolved a theory according to which Jesus, when a young man, lived with these Qumran people there and learned things from them and learned from them about the teacher of righteousness who was the founder of the group, and consciously modeled his life after that of the teacher of righteousness. And most Christian ideas are derived from the ideas of this group there at Qumran. Now, this French writer developed such ideas to quite an extent. And then a man in New York wrote an article for the New Yorker magazine in two parts, in which he popularized this theory and presented it, and then what he wrote was made into a book which has been translated into at least a dozen languages. I'd think more likely 25 or 30. I know, for instance, that translations were made into Danish, Swedish, and Norwegian. Those three different Scandinavian languages the book was translated and distributed in. Such writings appeared as this. How wonderful to go to this place at Qumran and to realize that at this very table probably Jesus sat as he was learning about the teaching of righteousness and learning these things which you find in the New Testament. And there is a man in England named Allegro, A-L-L-E-G-R-O, who has studied the Dead Sea Scrolls extensively. And it stated in Time magazine about 10 years ago that he made a talk on the Dead Sea Scrolls over the British Broadcasting Corporation, in which he said that in the Dead Sea Scrolls we saw that the teacher of righteousness had been crucified and was supposed to have risen from the dead, and that that is where they got the idea of Jesus having been crucified and risen from the dead. And Time magazine said that other scholars in England, reading this or hearing this that Allegro had given on the radio, immediately rushed to see him, to see the new scrolls he had, because they were so interested and thrilled to think that this had been found. And the Times said that when they talked to Allegro, they found he had no new scrolls. He simply had the same scrolls they all were familiar with. But he interpreted it that way, because the scrolls say that the wicked priest strongly opposed the teacher of righteousness. And so, he says, the teacher of righteousness must have been killed. And if he was killed, how would you be killed in those days but to be crucified? So he must have been crucified. It's purely a conclusion drawn with no evidence whatever. No solid scholar in the world, I believe, except a legal, would say there's any evidence whatever that the teacher of righteousness was a martyr, certainly none that he was crucified. Not even a statement that he was killed anywhere that has been found yet in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But this has been popularized over the world that this is where the ideas of Christianity come from, in the statements of these Dead Sea Scrolls. And so tremendous harm has been done through this teaching that Christianity is simply a carrying on of the teachings of these, when actually the similarities are very, very slight. Professor Burroughs of Yale wrote a book on it in which he pointed out that the similarities of the teachings of Jesus to the sayings of the rabbis are far closer than any similarity that can be found between them and the non-biblical Dead Sea Scrolls. But the idea has been widely circulated and has done great harm, and it's absolutely without foundation. There is no evidence that anyone ever thought this teacher of righteousness was divine, that he had wrought miracles, that his death had any special meaning, or that he had risen from the dead. But some have imagined these things and have widely distributed these unfortunate anti-Christian theories. Yes, Mr. Warner?
Can you tell us the question that the Americans
I should be able to. They're on the tip of my tongue, but they don't get any further. I had not been sure I'd go into this. This is really the Old Testament. This is more a general situation. And I had not looked up their precise names again. The Frenchman has a name with two parts to it. He wrote quite a number of books on the subject. And the American, it seems to me it's Wilson. I'm not quite sure though. But he is a critic who has written a good many books on literature. A very well-known critic in New York. He wrote these two articles in the New Yorker and this book, which first got the widespread attention to the scroll. But, yes?
Let me ask you, since the Dead Sea Scrolls are 60 years earlier than the
Maryland, yeah. It all depends how well they're copied and what they're copied from. So you could copy, you could have a copy of a manuscript made today, copied from one that was made 30 years ago. And somebody else could have a copy made yesterday that was copied from one made 500 years ago. You cannot tell just by the date when one is made how close it is. It depends more on what it's copied from, and there's no way to prove that. So that 60 years would be hardly worth mentioning as far as that's concerned. But there is this difference, that at the time when the Qumran scrolls were made, the Jews were in peace and people could go back and forth as they felt like, and there were doubtless many copies of the scripture being circulated. Whereas in the time 60 years later, after the great bulk of the Jews had been taken into slavery or had fled, probably there were comparatively few people having copies, and they would represent the official copies in Jerusalem rather than the popular copies that would be more freely distributed during the time of peace before 70 AD. But this, as far as relation of time to the original, the 60 years wouldn't make any difference at all. Now the Dead Sea Scrolls thus have not put near as much light on the Hebrew text as we might wish, because aside from the Isaiah scroll and two or three shorter ones, most of them are tiny scraps. But doubtless some very valuable things will come from them eventually as they're studied more and more of them published. But the most important thing about them is they do show the remarkable accuracy and care with which they've been copied during the centuries since, because of their great similarity to the Hebrew Bible as we have it today. Well, now the fourth of the recent advances I wish to mention under this heading is the Aleppo manuscript. A-L-E-P-P-O. The Aleppo manuscript. 30 years ago, even 60 years ago, it was widely believed that the best Hebrew manuscript of the whole Old Testament that we have was a manuscript in the synagogue of the Sephardi Jews in Aleppo, a town in Lebanon, north of Palestine. And this was a very fine manuscript said to be made by Ben Asher, one of the Masoretes himself, who lived at about 900 AD. and very carefully made by him. And if a person wanted to know what is the Ben Asher text on a certain point, they could go to Aleppo and ask the keepers of the scroll in the synagogue there, and they would look up the passage and tell him, or they might even let him look at it himself. But and when they made the Kittel Bible, it was their desire to have the Aleppo manuscript be the manuscript used. But they found that the Aleppo manuscript was only used on two or three times a year on special occasions, was kept very, very carefully. And they absolutely refused to allow it to be photographed or to allow anybody to study it at length. And so, with great disappointment, the makers of the Kittel Bible decided instead to take a manuscript in Leningrad, which is somewhat later. Although it's a very fine manuscript, but somewhat later than this Ben Asher manuscript at Aleppo, which was generally considered to be the best manuscript of the extent of the whole Old Testament. The men at Aleppo simply refused and to allow others to study it at length at any time, and absolutely refused to allow it to be photographed. Then in 1947, when the Palestine was divided in two, you had riots all through the Near East against the Jews. And in one of these riots, the Aleppo synagogue was destroyed. It was burned down. And for quite a time, it was thought that the manuscript had perished. However, there were certain men in Jerusalem who were very anxious to try to find it and to see if it could possibly have been preserved. And a few years later, they gave out the word, I think it was about 1960, a little before, they gave out the word that they had been able to come in contact with some men in Aleppo who had rescued the manuscript. And that about a fourth of the manuscript had been burned in the burning of the synagogue, but the rest had been preserved. And they managed to work it out to get it taken to Jerusalem. And so now, what is left of the manuscript, which is about three-fourths of it, is in the hands of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And they are planning a great series of volumes that will have this manuscript at their center, and then will compare it with other manuscripts, and we'll have a tremendous amount of very valuable material for study of the Hebrew Bible. Yes?
If there is a journal of magazine that comes out that deals with these recent discoveries or research manuscripts?
Well, this one, the Hebrew University has issued in English an annual volume called Textus, T-E-X-T-U-S, and it has pictures of portions of this Aleppo manuscript and articles on the general subject. They've had about six or seven issues up to the present of this magazine Textus, but there are quite a number of magazines that occasionally have articles in this general area. Yes, Mr. Brett? Yes, yes.
What generally
Yes, it is generally so believed to be. Well, of course, it's about a fourth of it's destroyed now. And they found just recently, the latest, about 2 years ago, an issue of Textus came out, which told how a British missionary, I think in 1894, made a visit to this synagogue. And they let him photograph two pages of Genesis. And they appeared in an English missionary magazine, and they have copied it. They have copied the photograph in Textus. And this is part of what is destroyed in it. So it's very fun to have those two pages. And some way, these Jews there did on two or three occasions allow a Christian to photograph a page or two, but they never let any Jew photograph any of them. And so they're glad to have that much of it available for you. Now, you see. Yes? Codex, yes, and Codex. Codex, definitely. Well, there is no manuscript of the whole Old Testament other than Codex form. If you put it in a scroll, it would reach across the room and back several times. It would take you all day to find any place, you see. A scroll will never contain more than, at the very most, the Pentateuch. I don't think it ever would be the Pentateuch, probably just one of the books of the Pentateuch. I guess the Psalms is about the biggest scroll you'll ever find. Homer, for instance, if you study the Iliad, it has so many books in it. There's about 12 books in the Iliad. And see, each of them represents a scroll. It was entirely in scrolls until the 3rd or 4th century A.D. And, of course, all the Dead Sea manuscripts are scrolls, pieces of scrolls. Well, there is material from all these discoveries that I'll mention a little later as we go on. But now we go on to capital B, Hebrew manuscripts. Hebrew manuscripts, number one, types. Types. There are two main types of manuscripts. There are the synagogue manuscripts and the private manuscripts. The synagogue manuscripts are all scrolls. And these do not have vowel points in. They just have the consonantal text. There are definite rules preserved as to how the synagogue scrolls are to be made. They must be made in scrolls, certain kind of material, certain kind of ink. They must be done with very great care. They are very strict rules. Hardly any synagogue scrolls of any age are available. When the synagogue scroll became worn out, it was quite sure to be buried and thus had disappeared altogether. Very few of synagogue scrolls of any age are available. The other type is the private manuscripts, and it was understood that every Jewish family was expected during the Middle Ages to have at least one copy of the law in its possession. Each family should have at least one copy of the Pentateuch and as much else of the scripture as they could afford. And so there were many of these private copies. And the private copies are mostly in codex form. And, of course, you get much more material in a codex. And the codices, some are made with great care, some with far less care. It was customary that one man copy the consonantal text, that another man go through and write in the vowels, and another man go in and write through the accents and the footnotes. It was, and then a fourth man is supposed to examine it and check very carefully and correct any errors. Of course, whether you could do it as fully as that would depend partly on whether you had the money to pay for that much work. But the attempt was made to have the scrolls preserved very carefully. Now, that's number one, type. Number two, age. The age of manuscripts is sometimes hard to prove because the people were not writing in this for their ordinary writing. Now, Greek manuscripts we can date pretty accurately by the type of writing because the people who wrote them were people who were writing Greek letters all the time. And so the way they wrote Greek letters gradually changed, and by the type of letters you can date fairly well. But in this case, the Hebrew letters were only used for copying the Bible and for a few other writings. Most of their writing would be done in Arabic if they were in the Muslim world, or done in Latin or in Greek, whatever region they were in. And so from the manner of writing, you cannot tell as much about the age of a manuscript in Hebrew as you can in the Greek. Manuscripts, most of them, have a statement of the time when they were written. But unfortunately, some of them seem to have been copied by men who didn't know much Hebrew. And if you have one copied by a man who doesn't know much Hebrew, it may be a better copy than if a man does know Hebrew, because he's apt to watch every little thing to get it exact and not to have an idea in his head and write it down and perhaps make a little mistake in writing. But some of these, if they were written by men who didn't know much Hebrew, it would seem may have been the case because they copy the statement of the dates. So it is thought that some of the dates are simply copied from a previous manuscript. And then the dating. As you doubtless know, there was no system in the world of dating year after year until 312 B.C. Up to then, all dates were according to the ruler or so many years after the earthquake or something like that. The year when so-and-so was consul in Rome. Then in 312 B.C., men who conquered, who captured Babylon, Seleucus it was, father of Antiochus, one of Alexander's generals, Seleucus, seized Babylon in 312 and established the Seleucid kingdom there. And that day 312 was used by his successors, and it's the only system used for some centuries after that that anybody used to date 1 year after the other. And so the Jews, even as late as 1000 A.D., were dating from 312 B.C. They would say like 1000 A.D. might be the year 1312. But in dating a manuscript, often they didn't bother to write 1312, they just write 312, or even just write 12. And we often just say year 70. We put a dash 70. Well, that's plain enough. When you see somebody did something in 68, you know it wasn't 1868. But somebody 1,000 years from now might not know whether it was 1568 or 1868. And so the fact that sometimes they only give the last two letters or the last three is confusing that way. Fortunately, the manuscript, the Leningrad manuscript that is used in the Kittel Bible, has in the end of it a dating according to several systems. It dates it from Ptolemy, or from Seleucus rather. It dates it from the beginning of the world, according to their figuring. It dates it from Muhammad, which was the dating used in the part of the world where it was made. It has these several different systems of dating, and so that it makes it easy to figure the date of that particular manuscript. But the dating straight along in numbers like we do did not become common in the world until after 400 A.D., when a monk named Dionysius tried to figure out when Christ was born. And he cited from his figuring how many years after Christ's birth it was then. And so he called that A.D. so-and-so, so many years after Christ was born. Well, he was 5 or 6 years off in his figuring. So Christ was actually born 5 or 6 B.C. But that system became established, and we have used it ever since. But in previous years, we didn't have it, and the Jews did not accept that system, so that they do not date their manuscripts from Christ. But the dates, thus, are difficult often to be sure of manuscripts. We have a great many manuscripts after 1100, from 1100 to 1400, a great many. Before 1100, comparatively few. Yes? Dionysius. D-I-O-N-Y-S-I-U-S. Dionysius. So that the manuscripts we had, comparatively few, before 1100, until Firkovich and the Kyrogeniza made available to us maybe 50 more. 50 or 60 more than we had from before 1100. And these manuscripts, this material in the Kyrogeniza, has also given us the names of some of the Masoretes. Now the Masoretes, M-A-S-S-O-R-E-T-E-S. M-A-S-S-O-R-E-T-E-S. It's spelled two or three different ways. That's one good way. The Masoretes were the group of Jews who put in the vowel mark. And it used to be thought that they were at about 500 A.D., but from the material in the Kyrogeniza, we know that they were between 800 and 900 A.D., were the Masoretes. We know the names of some of the leaders of them now. And these Masoretes studied the manuscripts available. We have references to a number of manuscripts that they had available to them that are no longer in existence. But they studied the manuscript, and it was not customary then to have any vowel markers, although there had been some manuscripts that had Greek letters put up to indicate a vowel. Yes, Mr. Gordon? Yes, in Tiberias. There were two or three different groups of Masoretes, but the ones that we follow today were in Tiberias, T-I-B-E-R-I-A-S. And for about a century, these men worked in developing a system of indicating vowels and also a system of accents to show the way that you would sing the scripture in the services, the way you would chant it. And these accents show where you put the accent and different types of musical approach to it and so on. A very complicated system of accents for the historical books and a different one for the poetical books. But they worked out the system of vowels, and they rather standardized the language, because naturally the language passed on, a dead language passed on from father to son, changed in its pronunciation quite a bit. But they standardized it pretty well, and they worked out an excellent system. They compared them closely, and they carried on work that had been done by scribes before of counting the number of letters in every book, finding the middle letter of the Pentateuch. You'll find your Hebrew Bible written larger than other letters to show it's the middle letter in the Pentateuch. They found what's the middle letter of each part, how many, what's the middle word, and how many words, how many letters, and so on. Did all sorts of things like that in order to keep the text exact and careful and prevent mistakes from it. They tried, as they said, to make a hedge about the law to protect it from error. And they did wonderfully well. But the men who, the scribes worked on this through the centuries, but this group of Masoretes in this century worked out the vowel system and the system of accents and did a very excellent piece of work in that, which has been accepted by all the Jews ever since. Well, I see we'll have to stop for the day to go further there tomorrow.